Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ryan's Remarkable Mycology Podcast. I have an important announcement to share before we get going, and I suppose you could say it's a little bit bittersweet, but this is going to be the last episode of this podcast in its current form, and I'll expand on that. So, mycology is definitely one of my passions, but, you know, hey, I'm a complex guy, what can I say? I got a lot of passions. And you may have noticed that I have not been posting as many episodes lately, and that's because I've been recently throwing all of my mental energy behind a creative writing project, which I won't get into right now, but essentially what my idea is for the future of this podcast is to turn it into a book and film review show. As I've gone through this process, I realize that I actually have a lot to say, and I'm not saying that it's going to be the most insightful analysis you've ever heard, but I'm going to try to put a personal touch on it. And for those of you that have followed my previous blogs, for example, One Stupid Decision, where I kind of went into my entire life leading up to a decision to go on a 3-month road trip. And I, you know, learned a lot about myself and about my priorities, and I want to do something similar here, but in the format of film and book reviews, if that makes sense. My first episode will be about Spirited Away, Hayao Miyazaki's timeless classic, which I actually have a blog post already about, and in podcast form, it will be pretty similar. I might add a little bit more. And you know, we're going to see how it goes. So, you can find the blog if you would like at remarkablemushroomemporium.com. That domain will be changing shortly. But for now you can check it out. I have a number of mycology centric episodes planned as a continuation and homage to the wonderful community that I've created here. So for instance, I'm going to be reviewing Entangled Life by Merlin Sheldrake, which is one of my favorite nonfiction books ever, and really got me on this whole mycology craze. I'm also going to do How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan, another excellent book that I would love to revisit. And then I'm also very excited to announce I have an interview planned with the author of a children's book called Mason Goes Mushrooming. They're being so kind as to send me a free copy, and I'm going to review the author. So that should be really, really amazing, and expressing gratitude for that. Anyways, I can't begin to express my gratitude and love for the community that this podcast has created. I know it's been a short run, but a lot of people have reached out with really kind words, and I want to just say thank you for that. I've also learned so much from the amazing guests that we've had on this podcast, and I would like to give them a little bit of kudos right now. So Henry Carignan, a wonderful guy who runs Fungal Fruition Consulting, was my first episode, and that was all about mushroom cultivation and Mycology 101. So go check that out and check Henry out. That's episode 1. Functional Mushrooms with Alex Dorr. Alex runs a very successful business and was kind enough to give me a bit of his time to talk about functional and medicinal mushrooms, and he's a really awesome guy. Hernan Castro runs Desert Alchemist, and we talked all about wild forage extracts. Langdon Cook was a speaker for one of the Colorado Mycological Society meetings, and we went into a very detailed and interesting conversation about foraging for mushrooms. And I actually think that is my favorite and my best episode. So that's episode 4. Mark Violo of Myco Stories, another amazing guy, really hard worker, and has created a wonderful community of his own. So go check out Myco Stories. And then finally, our most recent episode besides this one was Myco Materials with Catherine Yule and Jessica Diaz of Fungal Matters. Two wonderful women who gave me a lot of excellent content. So, yeah, that all that being said, I want to just talk a little bit about the next iteration of this podcast. So I'm calling it Ryan's Remarkable Book and Film Review Show. Bit of a mouthful, so if you have any ideas for for a shorter name, I'm all ears. And yeah, like I said, I'm going to be talking about some of my favorite books and films. I'm also going to be talking about my own creative journey with writing. You know, writing and research, I think I've discovered, are two of my big main passions. And I'm really excited to bring all of that to you all in a variety of episodes. You know, I think each movie or book is going to have a different theme and have a different topic, which I can really delve deep into in podcast form. So I'm very excited, and I hope you will stay with the podcast if you are already subscribed. And if this new podcast just doesn't interest you, you're like, oh, books? I don't read them. Who needs books? Then you can feel free to unsubscribe. I don't have any hard feelings. I just thought I would, you know, repurpose the existing audience that I have already. And yeah, that's basically my spiel about the new film and book review show. So all that being said, let's go ahead and get into the meat of this episode. Craig Sanchez is a self-taught ethnomycologist who has been the president of Colorado Mycological Society 3 separate times. On this episode, we're going to delve deep into the topic of ethnomycology. What is it? Why is it so important? And what we need to understand and have respect for about historical and spiritual uses of mushrooms. Specifically, Greg did a research report on ethnomycology related to Mesoamerica. That's, you know, the region that Mexico is in, where a lot of ancient mushroom knowledge comes from. So we go into all of that, talk about aforementioned mushroom knowledge and the ecology of the region, as well as some of the dark history of indigenous exploitation in the story of Maria Sabina. We're also gonna just talk generally about the so-called mushroom moment that seems to be pulsating throughout our society. And we're gonna go into some of the exciting developments aside from ethnomycology, such as the uses of fungi for medicinals, food, materials, mycoremediation, and psychedelic therapy. These are some topics that we have discussed in previous episodes, but Craig has some really excellent insight, and he has been, you know, foraging and researching mushrooms for 20 years. So the guy is seriously a never-ending bank of knowledge, and I really love this episode. I think it's a great one to go out on, and yeah, let's not delay any further. Let's go ahead and get into the episode. All right, so I am here with my first in-person interview with Greg Sanchez. Greg has served 3 times as the president of the Colorado Mycological Society. That's actually where I met him. He was coordinating volunteers at the Mushroom Fair in early August, which was a lot of fun. So I volunteered there, chatted with Greg, and he's got a lot to share knowledge-wise. Specifically today, we're going to be talking about ethnomycology, which I will let Greg explain because I think his definition will be better than mine. So Greg, why don't you go ahead and just introduce yourself, and yeah, we can get into it.
All right. As Ryan said, my name is Greg Sanchez. I've been part of the Colorado Mycological Society since about 2004, and I got on the board and was president, and really good organization. I mean, it's nice to have the history and the passion that we have. But the topic ethnomycology is a little bit different than most topics you hear about when you get into mushrooms. Ethnomycology deals more with the human social connections. And so a lot of connections to social sciences, economics, history, geography, but also humanities. And so we get into arts and culture. It covers a diverse number of topics. And I think, it's a branch of ethnobotany. So if you're familiar with ethnobotany, ethnomycology is kind of an extension of that. But I think the thing I'm more recently understanding, it's also involves attitudes and perceptions. And so I think those are important when we look at mushrooms and think about mushrooms and ask questions about mushrooms.
All right. And also, in case you weren't aware, since I just really posted about this yesterday, this is being live streamed on Instagram. So we got two firsts. We got the first in person and the first Instagram live stream. So hopefully it turns out okay. why don't you, I guess you already kind of introduced the concept of ethnomycology. So before we, really get deep into the historical aspect of it, could you talk a little bit about some of the ways that you see mushrooms being talked about in modern culture?
Oh yeah. I think we're really in a heavy mushroom moment. And one source in particular, if you're not familiar with it, Fantastic Fungi, the film. That film has really opened a lot of people's eyes to the potential and just the different dimensions of mushrooms. And so popular media is definitely helping us, but at the same time, it's kind of hurting us because there are some negative perceptions, like what was the show on HBO?
Oh, The Last of Us?
The Last
of
Us.
Yeah, Cordyceps. Yeah, Cordyceps are evil.
Yeah, and some of the misinformation, I think, is really something we have to try to work with. But I teach high school, and one of the big connections I see with students is fashion. Mushroom fashion has become very popular, and one thing I like to see now too is that a lot of times the mushrooms are more accurately depicted, and so I think that's pretty cool to see that people are just getting exposed, and it's interesting because I ask students if they've ever seen those mushrooms, they're like, no, and so I show them pictures and they say, yeah, those are real mushrooms, and they get excited and start asking more questions. So it not just with fashion, food, medicinals are huge and becoming more and more, more and more available. And every day you see more research come out. I just saw something yesterday that was just reinforcing the benefits of lion's mane. And so these are becoming more mainstream for people to really understand that, hey, these are useful tools. So.
Absolutely. So Greg gave a talk about a year ago for the Colorado Mycological Society, and he has a lot of really interesting research about the traditional spiritual uses of mushrooms, particularly entheogenic. Some people might know those as psychedelic mushrooms. So I think we're going to kind of use that as a guidepost for this conversation. So before we get too into the weeds on this, do you want to start with giving us some definitions of the key terms that you'll be talking about?
So when we look at these topics and even the psychedelic renaissance from a historical perspective, these aren't new things. I mean, mushrooms have been used for thousands of years, and specifically Mesoamerica is kind of the historical era that we think about, but it's also a region in southern Mexico and Central America. And so when we talk about Mesoamericans, we're talking about Aztecs, Mayans, some of the indigenous groups that came from those areas. And so that's where a lot of this started, and the knowledge of it, where it's really come from.
Absolutely. What about some of the other terms that you talk about, like mycolatry? That was a new one for me as I was watching your talk. What is that?
Yeah, mycolatry is, I don't think that really caught on. It was a term that was developed by Gordon Wasson. And Gordon Wasson's one of the key figures that was really the pioneer of ethnomycology. He did a lot of the research, and he's kind of he's got the unfortunate history of exposing Maria Sabina, and we'll talk about her as well.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
The mycology really, from his perspective, focused on more of the religious connection, religious and spiritual connections of mushroom use. And so when we talk about psychoactives, I think the term entheogen is one that we want to mention. Because it's one thing to call something a drug and the perception that goes with that. But if you call it an entheogen, then it has a different intention. You know, entheogens are used for spiritual purposes and held in really sacred spaces, you know, versus a drug which may be used for recreational purposes. And so I think just the perception that you have about these topics has a lot to do with, you know, how you understand them. And when you start looking at the history behind it, you start to appreciate that, well, yeah, they were doing things differently for different reasons.
Absolutely. So Mesoamerica is definitely a different environment than I'm used to looking for mushrooms in. I think the ecology is something that I found interesting in your talk. Could you talk a little bit about the ecology of Mexico and the general Mesoamerican region and what that means for the types of mushrooms you'll find?
Yeah, so when you look at mushrooms, period, habitat is essential. And so in Mexico and in the regions where Mesoamerica was, is pretty diverse. I mean, very tropical areas. There's mountainous regions, mixed vegetation, and really ideal habitat, not just for the psilocybe species, but for many species. And even just one of the statistics I came across, 450 species of wild mushrooms are consumed in Mexico as both food and medicine. And so just to think of the diversity that's there, it's really because of the habitat and the climate zones and all that.
Another thing that I found interesting that I didn't know before watching your talk was how the psilocybe mexicana mushroom has been used, particularly for synthesizing some psychedelic compounds. Can you talk a little bit about that and where that all comes from?
Yeah, for sure. So when we talk about the genus psilocybe, that's really the genus that has a number of species that are psychoactive. They vary in area in terms of the growing, the seasons that they grow, but Mexicana in particular has kind of been famous because it was the mushroom that Albert Hofmann, the LSD chemist, used to synthesize psilocybin and psilocin. And so it was from samples that he was given by Gordon Wasson that he was able to extract the compounds and to develop them synthetically as well. There is another interesting story with that, where after he synthesized the psilocybin and psilocin, he brought samples back to Maria Sabina, and she was the curandera, the shaman who introduced Gordon Wasson to the mushrooms. But he wanted to see if they worked the same, if the synthetic worked the same, and she felt it did. And she said that this would be something I could use when I can't find mushrooms. Oh. So I think just knowing that the connection with the science and the indigenous use was pretty strong, and that they used Mexicana as a species in particular to do that synthesis.
Very cool. Okay, so moving on to some of the history that you go over in this talk, I know the Mesoamerican history, you know, could be a 1,500 page book on its own.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different cultures that come and go. But I think the Mayans and the Aztecs seem to be the ones that had the most evidence to support mushroom usage or just mushroom artifacts, things like that.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because they're the more recent cultures, but, you know, who's to say? So what are some of the more interesting or just like some of the examples that come to mind when you think about how mushrooms were used in those cultures?
Yeah, and so one of the problems with some of the history is that it's not really well documented. And part of the problem was because of the Spanish influence. And so when the Spaniards came, they really wanted to do away with native practices that they felt may have had religious connections because Christianity was the focus. And so one artifact that did survive in limited numbers are mushroom stones. And mushroom stones, they look like mushrooms, but they also include various mythological figures and you know, jaguars and monkeys and other important spiritual animals. But with the human depictions in these mushroom stones, you see really interesting facial expressions and almost that people are deep in thought. And there is question about whether or not they were really used in mushroom ceremonies, but some of the research I've seen and I've done suggests that because there's also a connection with grinding in the mushroom stones, and the grinding was used to consume mushroom. They would grind some mushrooms to consume them. And so there is some evidence that suggests that there was a direct connection, but the reality is there's not a lot of history that supports specific uses.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Mayans, that's one of the big ones that you see. The mushroom stones are really, really amazing. If you search for those images, you'll find some really interesting examples.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I found interesting was some of the artifacts have been featured in the Denver Art Museum, which I thought was pretty cool.
Well, and if I could touch on those too, I mean, sure. and some of the features also suggest intoxication of mushrooms and one in the Denver Art Museum in particular, I haven't seen it in the collections, but it's been identified as one of part of their collection. You see mushroom being presented as like it's being offered with a hand outreached. And even the dilated pupils that go with the figure depicted in the mushroom stone. And those are definitely characteristics of mushroom intoxication or psilocybin intoxication.
Yeah.
So
there you have it. Okay, so I think one of the more fascinating stories of that, I think it's kind of iconic at this point in the mushroom and so especially psychedelic mushroom community, is the story of Gordon Wasson and Maria Sabina. So do you want to talk a little bit about that and especially, you know, the influence that all of the attention that, you know, white people brought to these traditional sacred practices. I thought that was really compelling. So do you want to touch on that a little?
Yeah, certainly. And I think maybe to frame it, we also got to acknowledge the female and the woman connection.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon Wasson is a name that is going to come up a lot when you look at sacred mushroom rituals and Western influence or Western discovery. But you also have to give credit to his wife, Valentina. His wife was a Russian American, and she grew up with a strong tradition of hunting mushrooms and eating mushrooms, wild mushrooms, you know. And even there's a story on their honeymoon where she went crazy because she found all these mushrooms where they were at in the Catskills, and he was freaked out because he thought she was going to die because she wanted to eat them. And gradually, as the story goes, she converted him. And made him realize that these aren't things that you should be afraid of. These are things that you should really appreciate and love. And so it's partly from her influence that Gordon Wasson really started doing his explorations as well. And so the story with Wasson, he was a banker. He worked for J.P. Morgan. He was like a vice president, one of the executives. And because of his wife's influence, they had a curiosity on different cultural uses of mushrooms. And even with that term mycology, you know, they had a theory that mushrooms did play a role in the development of religions. And so they wanted to explore these stories, I guess, at that time. Where that led him, he heard stories about activities going on in Mesoamerica from other important figures like Schultes. I don't know if you're familiar with Richard Evans Schultes. He was an ethnobotanist from Harvard, and he was one of the guys who really went out and found some of these practices. Didn't participate in them, but he learned about them. And so Wasson hears about this, and then he sets off and does some explorations to Mexico in the Sierra Mazatecs, starts asking questions about, well, where can we learn more about these practices, unfortunately he kind of came under false pretense. He wanted to learn, but in order to really get experienced with people like Maria Sabina, he wasn't truthful in what he was doing. You know, he asked, saying that it was for health reasons, and he wanted to find and solve problems, but he really just wanted to explore the culture and learn more about the tradition of the mushroom use. And for him, he was really given credit as being the first Westerner to be exposed and actually participate and consume the mushrooms in ceremony. And then later on, he wrote about this in Life magazine. And it was because of the Life magazine article that Maria Sabina and her indigenous practice was really kind of exposed, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. So
let's talk a little bit more about Maria Sabina, because she's definitely a very well-known figure by this point. But there's also, you know, like you brought up, the sort of exploitative attention that was brought onto her, you know, without her really probably knowing any better. And now she's kind of being turned into a sort of cultural icon with, you know, T-shirts and artwork and posters and things like that. First off, like, do you want to talk a little bit about the spiritual ceremonies that she conducted and where that led to? And then, you know, also just like maybe some of your thoughts on that whole dynamic.
So Maria Sabina, she's a Mazatec. That's the culture that she's from. And she didn't speak Spanish. She didn't speak any other language but Mazatec. And actually she was identified as being illiterate. She couldn't even read. In her community, she was revered as a curandera, a shaman. I mean, she was a wise woman for her culture. And a curandera played the role of a counselor, a doctor, not necessarily religious figure, but definitely a spiritual elder. And so I think in her community, she was a very well-respected individual. As far as her involvement with mushrooms, she got involved at an early age, and there was a story of her. She wanted to help her sister who was sick, and so she asked the mushrooms for some answers. And I think from the research I did, I think she consumed like 30 pairs of mushrooms to try to solve the problem or to help solve the problems. Mm-hmm. And it was because of that experience that she was exposed to a world of knowledge that the mushroom showed her. And even one of the stories that she reported that the mushroom showed her a book of knowledge that she used to help understand more about how to solve problems. So her particular technique, and I think that's kind of important to at least differentiate, you know, when a shaman does their work, there are various techniques involved. Some shaman would do it in silence and just rely on maybe themselves consuming mushrooms and not necessarily include the other individuals. For Maria Sabina, her practice involves song and music. And so really, I mean, there are recordings of her, they call it velada. And that's her mushroom ceremony that involved chanting and music and really poetry, you know, and it's all in Mazatec. So, I mean, the translations you can find, but her technique involves song and these would be, I guess, ceremonies that would last, you know, 6 to 8 hours. You know, they would do a song, and then might take a break for a while, and then they do another song, and then just keep going the whole night to try to figure out, you know, answers to the questions that they're trying to understand.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think we've really gotten a lot of the history aspects of it. Do you want to talk a little bit about like how all of that has led to the current psychedelic renaissance that we're seeing, and maybe some of the ways that it's being used for mental health treatment, you know, and how it differs perhaps from some of the ceremonial practices that these people had?
Yeah. So I think when you look back at some of the indigenous use and native use, I think it's also important to acknowledge that these practices aren't gone. They're still taking place. You know, I think because of the European influence, they had to go underground for a while, but they still did the practices. They still, you know, these ceremonies are still happening. And I think, you know, from their perspective, the mushroom ceremonies would always be used to try to solve a problem, you know, and there were various rules that they had to follow, and there were prohibitions things they had to avoid, but they were always used for purposes of helping people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where kind of the psychedelic renaissance picks up, because people realize that hey, these are useful tools. These are things that we can benefit from. Even Gordon Wasson's wife, she was a pediatrician, and even from her experience early on, she realized that hey, there's potential here for psychiatric benefits, and those are things that people really started exploring more. And so, you know, the current psychedelic renaissance we're in really is a result of some of the work that's already been out there and some of the uses that were already done. And so I think it is good to see that modern medicine is finally realizing that, hey, these are useful things. And because they're doing them in clinical settings where they can monitor and regulate the amounts of psilocybin that they're using, they're seeing benefits. They're seeing great benefits, you know. I think some of the biggest things that science is showing us is that it can help rewire your brain, you know, and there are patterns of, there are behaviors that are problematic because the patterns are so ingrained that the brain can't get out of those patterns. And so when you look at things like serious depression and post-traumatic stress, the brain kind of needs to be mixed up a little bit in order to shift out of those patterns that are already fixed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's what they're realizing that psilocybin is able to do. But again, from a historical perspective, people knew this, and that's, I mean, they didn't know the science behind it, but they knew those are the things that they could do with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, we kind of blew through that talk, so I think maybe let's back up a little bit, and why don't you tell me a little bit about your mushroom story and how you got involved with this weird world of mycology, and maybe like what got you so interested in ethnomycology specifically.
Sure. So my own story started with the question, what do you do at a mushroom festival? And
what do you do at a mushroom festival?
everything you could imagine. Well, so I was on a vacation with my wife and my daughters in Telluride in 2004, and we were just there, you know, just on vacation, going to Durango. We stopped in Telluride, and I saw that there was a mushroom festival being advertised, and I was just curious, well, what do you do at a mushroom festival? And so I talked my wife into going back later in August to check it out. And so when I went, I was fortunate to have one of the keynote speakers that year be Paul Stamets. And this was before, like the year before, Mycelium Running came out. Mm-hmm. And that's one of his big books that really opened a lot more people's eyes. And so just to have that exposure to hearing him talk about how these mushrooms can heal the earth and save the planet. And, you know, all the dimensions from an environmental standpoint just fascinated me. And I just started thinking, well, how come more people don't talk about this stuff?
Yeah, right.
You know, and on top of him, Gary Linkoff, a really famous mycologist. He's the author of the Audubon Guide to to Mushroom, Field Guide to Mushrooms. He's a character. I mean, if you search some of his talks, you can still find some of his things. He's no longer with us, but some of his talks are available on YouTube. And just to hear him and his wit with how he explained mushrooms, and to go out on forays with them, and to eat mushrooms, you know, from a culinary standpoint. But also one of the big things that I was exposed to is the history and the cultural side. And there was a name, Ralph Metzner. He did work actually with Timothy Leary, mm-hmm. from Harvard, and he had a lot of experience from the psychological side. And he was one of the presenters that year that really exposed me more to just the potential in terms of helping people and how these things can be used to and have been used for years and years and years to treat different conditions and to support mental health, you know. And so from that point on, I was hooked, and I came across the Colorado Mycological Society here in Denver, and was able to get involved there. And, you know, really, I knew nothing about mushrooms until I started getting exposed at Telluride, and then CMS and all the talks that they offered, and then to go out in forays and to learn more. Little by little, you start to pick things up and you start to learn more information. And I've just come across so many amazing people over the years that are, and the community is just so supportive, mm-hmm. you know, always encouraging learning and helping people who just want to know, who want to learn more. So that's kind of where it took me. But the ethnomycology side is really, that's really something I connected very strongly with, because I teach social studies, and just the human connection is something that you can't deny. I mean, and not just the history and the culture, but the people.
Yeah.
You know, just meeting mushroom people, and you know, there's people I've met, and I only see them maybe once every couple of years, but when you get back and you connect with them again, it's like you pick up where you left off, and you know, it's just those kind of connections is really, really, really amazing.
Yeah. And Greg's full-time job is a social studies teacher, yeah. high school teacher. Yeah. He was telling me before he got on, he always takes the first three days of the school year off to go to Telluride Mushroom Festival. So
yeah.
I guess that's an easy way to ease it back into the year, except for maybe when you get back.
Well, yeah, preparing for a substitute for the days off is tough. But I've been able to, I've done presentations at Telluride. I've led some forays and just got really involved with that whole community as well. And yeah, it's always something I plan to miss school for, yeah. at the beginning of the year for sure.
Yeah, I definitely hope to make it out. Maybe when I have a little bit more spending money, yeah. hopefully next year that'll be.
There
you go. Yeah, so I guess, you know, on the subject of people, are there any, you know, figures in mycology or just like people you really look up to or respect that we haven't gone over? You know, we've talked about Gordon and Tina Wasson, yeah. Marina Sabina, a few other folks. Anyone else that comes to mind?
Yeah, so a couple names to throw out, and a lot of kind of where I'm coming from also is just to really give you a springboard for future or for further exploration. One big name that we have to acknowledge, Dr. Gaston Guzman. He is really a world-renowned expert on psilocybe. He wrote the monograph on the genus. And so he connected with Gordon Wasson and some of these. He was actually one of their interpreters, and he helped them with some of the travels they did. But he's a big one that we really have to acknowledge. And actually his daughter, Laura, is also a mycologist. And so she's continuing some of the work that her father did with the genus as well. Some other key figures, Rolf Singer, and he's a big name in mycology period, but he's had a lot of knowledge, he had a lot of history, did a lot of research with some of the early figures as well, and Schultes, Richard Evan Schultes, I think I mentioned him before. Mm-hmm. He is he's identified more as an ethnobotanist, but it's because of his research that people like Gordon Wasson were exposed to. But there are these practices that are still happening that made him curious.
Yeah. So outside of what we've talked about, you know, the psychedelic renaissance being, you know, all the rage right now, are there any other areas of mycology that you feel very energized by, or that you feel could have a really big impact on the world or the environment or what have you?
I think the medicinal side. I mean, medicinal mushrooms are still really kind of newish. Mm-hmm. Even though, I mean, there's a lot of companies that are selling brands, but there's a lot of new science that's starting to help us understand that this stuff is helpful. You know, lion's mane for neural support, and it's always identified for your brain. Turkey tail. I mean, there's been a lot of research done with turkey tail and different cancers. Cordyceps. You know, if you're an athlete and you want some support with oxygen levels, look into cordyceps, because I mean there are some clinical studies that have shown that over time, it does increase oxygen levels in your blood. But yeah, I mean, the medicinal side to me is really a whole new dimension, and not just the psychedelic side, but medicinals in general are something that I think have a lot of potential. Other industries I think that are really coming on are other materials like leather, mm-hmm. like substances that are made from things like Ganoderma. And so, I mean, they're realizing that they can grow mushrooms on waste and then use it like leather. And so you don't need cows. You don't need to use all the resources to raise cows for leather. You can grow mushrooms. And so I think just knowing building materials and those types of things are really exciting to see, that people are realizing, hey, there's so many more dimensions that we can use. And even more importantly, to help break down plastics.
Yeah.
You know, and that's been around for a while, but I think people are starting to really understand more of how to dial that in. And it's not just like planting mushrooms and letting them eat plastic. You gotta train certain mm-hmm. species to grow and to use those in those conditions. So.
Yeah. I agree with you on all fronts. I think there's so many exciting areas. You know, you tell somebody you're into mushrooms, they're thinking one thing, and I'm like, no, there's a lot more to it. So if you're interested in some of the stuff that Greg mentioned, you know, I direct you to episode 2 and 3 of the podcast. Shameless plug.
Yeah.
We had Alex Dorr of Mushroom Revival, who runs a functional and medicinal mushroom company. And then Hernan Castro of Desert Alchemist, his company focuses more on like wild forage extracts and combining them with herbal remedies. So very interesting talks. And then Myco Material, spoiler alert, we will be recording mid-September with a Myco Materials company. So very very much looking forward to that. Do you have a favorite mushroom or species or just either whether it's growing or just like something fascinating to you? What do you
I think the cliche would be they're all my favorite. But no, I think there's different mushrooms that I appreciate for different reasons. And also a shameless plug for me is we are working on a state mushroom for Colorado. And so we're reaching out to try to get people's feedback to see what mushroom you think would be a good symbol for our state, to go along with the tree and the flower and the birds and all those things. But some of the mushrooms I really like to see, the Hygrosibe conica. It's actually the cover photo on Vera Evanson's Rocky Mountain Mushroom Guidebook, the second edition, I guess. And it's a really almost translucent orangish cap. But the really cool characteristic is that when you touch it, it turns black. And so they call it the witch's cap. Because after you handle it, or if it, you just you're touching it for a while, it just turns black. But just the beauty of that mushroom, it's always something to see. From a smelling standpoint, the Hidnelum suaviolens, and this is a mushroom that once you smell it, you can't mistake it for anything else. It's a tooth mushroom. It's a white. There's a white cap. It's got teeth and a blue stem, really deep blue stem, and the smell is so distinctive. But it's something if you ask two dozen people what it smells like, they'll give you two dozen descriptions. So it's something that's so familiar, but it's really hard to pin down. And I mean, I've heard everything from licorice to patchouli to baby powder was one that I could connect with, honestly. But it's a really fragrant and really pleasant smelling mushroom.
Cool.
So those are some of the ones that I really like.
Those are the best answers I've gotten. I've asked that question to a lot of guests, and everybody else has usually picks a more common one, but those were some wild cards.
Well, and I think the thing that a lot of people have to understand too, I mean, when you experience a mushroom, you have to use all your senses. Definitely the smells and the tastes. And even with poisonous mushrooms, you can taste them as long as you don't ingest them. And there are some mushrooms you really do have to get the flavor of what's with it in order to identify it, more accurately. So, but yeah, definitely use all your senses. You can kiss them. They won't kiss you back, but
Well, they might if you're on a certain kind of mushroom, maybe you'll see that. Cool. Well, you are a plethora of knowledge. I went on a foray with you about a week ago, a week and a half ago, maybe. I learned a lot, and you've been foraging since about 20 years, has it
Yeah,
been?
almost, yeah.
So, what would you say is one piece of advice you have for somebody getting involved either with, mushroom foraging, wanting to learn more about specific mushrooms in their region, or just like interested in learning more about mycology and mushrooms in general?
Well, for one, I would definitely plug a mycological society or a mushroom club, some kind of formal organization, because you're gonna come in touch with people who are knowledgeable and experienced. And so I think that's really one of the keys. You want to go with somebody who knows not just how to look for mushrooms, how to find mushrooms. And then there's a difference there. Learning habitat is important. And it's very humbling because you realize, well, okay, well, I want to learn mushrooms, but now I got to know trees and I got to know plants and I got to know temperature and humidity and all these other things. And I think if anything, the biggest advice I would say is pace yourself, right? I mean, just take it slow. I have learned a lot over the years, but I've been doing it for a few years, right? And so it's not something you're necessarily going to pick up overnight. I mean, there are people who are that quick with it, but Most people, it takes time, you know, and so patients learn a few every year and do your homework, you know. I mean, there's a lot of books, a lot of field guides, a lot of YouTube talks, and even you can jump on talks from other mycological societies where you know, you can listen to presentations and hear other people talk about mushrooms and different dimensions of it. And so I guess if you're curious, explore it, because mm-hmm. there's so many different directions. And I think for me, the one of the really big things that really keeps me interested is I can always change direction. You know, yeah. I might be interested in this for now, then I can go off in another direction and learn something else. And so there's room for everybody, which is awesome. And the worst mushroom hunt, the worst thing that's going to happen on mushroom hunt is you take a good hike in a beautiful environment.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I had a fun time on our foray because there were a lot of wildflowers. So I made like a little bouquet of flowers. Yeah. And, you know, I found actually some really good mushrooms that day too. But I always like to have those little side quests, you know, if it's not the best day. I think we talked a little bit about you in the intro, about you being the president of the Colorado Mycological Society for three separate years. Yeah. So you've obviously seen your fair share of talks there. Do you have any that stand out? Any favorites?
Oh man. With the Colorado Mycological Society, I mean that's an organization that's over 50 years old, and I think we have kind of some extra good things going for us. I mean, for one, the history. And a lot of our members know some really well-known mycologists. You know, I think we've had writers and people who've authored mushroom field guides. I'd say the one that probably I would have to say stands out the most is Paul Stamets.
Yeah, that would be a standout for sure.
He goes way back with some of our members that are no longer with us, but he was in town for a dermatology convention, actually. He was a keynote speaker for a dermatology convention, and he reached out to some of our members and that knew him for a long time, and they said, well, and he told them, if you got the space, I'll speak for free because I'm here.
That's awesome.
And so he was willing to just come in, you know, just like that, and to do a talk for us. We had over 300 people show up for that talk.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was awesome because, I mean, just to hear him, he's definitely a cheerleader.
Oh, yeah.
For the mushrooms and a Michael celebrity if there's ever one.
It's great too because he's like totally self-taught.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure if you're tuning in, you know the story of Paul Stamets, but if you don't, I would encourage you to watch Fantastic Fungi.
Yeah.
That is one of the things that really got me into the field. So, that would be a pretty special speaker for sure. So, I see a few more people have joined the chat. Unfortunately, we are just wrapping up. We went through our main talk pretty quick, but if you have any questions for Greg, we went over Mesoamerican cultures and how they've traditionally used fungi in Aztec and Mayan cultures, and then obviously even going forward to today. So we had a really great talk. And did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Well, I do want to plug another organization, the Fungi Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization out of Chile. And Juliana Ferchi, I mean, that's another name you got to look into if you don't know her. An amazing Chilean mycologist. And I mean, she's done a ton for mushrooms, but she has a division in her foundation that's called the Elders Program. And one of their jobs or one of their tasks is to try to map and document oral history around the world, you know, mushroom history. And so not just psychoactives, but, all kinds of native uses in different parts of the world. And so I know they're still collecting information and they're still publishing things, but look up the Elders Program from the Fungi Foundation. And, you know, just exciting to see that they're doing the work to try to keep a hold of this history.
Definitely. All right. Well, it seems like the live stream has been picking up steam, but we're gonna be letting you all go. If you're interested in hearing the beginning of this talk, I will be posting the full podcast episode. Shout out to, oh look, my mom joined. Hi, mom. thank you so much, Greg, for being on. We're gonna end the live stream now, and like I said, stay tuned. You can find the podcast feed in the bio of my Instagram. You can also follow the Instagram. I'll be posting updates when the episode is out. Thank you all for joining, and we'll see you later.
Awesome.